Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Isn't any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and not?
The biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
I think we've gone about, I think this is the fourth or fifth week, so I think it's a good time to kind of recap what we've done so far and sort of get our bearings on where we've been and where we're going. So for our first week, our zeroth week, we had Dr. Micah Green give us a very, very broad overview on how to conceptually discuss the Old Testament, especially in relationship with Christian theology. Then our first official week, we talked about the text of the Old Testament, or the Tanakh, or Hebrew Bible. All of these are synonymous. And we talked about the Masoretic text as the primary Hebrew foundation for the text that we have, and the Greek Septuagint is another version that's out there. And we also talked about how the text was composed, and the inspiration is more of a process and not an event. It's not like God sort of takes over a writer and makes him move like a puppet in order to write down what happens. There are many hands involved, and divine inspiration occurs over many generations. The week after that, we started our sort of excursus on this question of evolution and creation. So we started by addressing the interpretive questions of the primeval history, which is Genesis 1 through 11. The main takeaways there is that the genre of these 11 chapters are widely considered to be proto-history, which is to say these are historical events and people, but they are cloaked in the mythological language of exalted prose. Last week, we started talking about integrating Genesis with science. And here we talked about the various interpretations in the history of Jewish and Christian debates over Genesis, especially with the relationship to the age of the earth. And we discussed that of the myriad of views that are available, only the literal calendar day interpretation is really in any serious conflict with contemporary science regarding the age of the universe. We also talked about the question of common ancestry and how that relates to the interpretation of the kinds of Genesis 1. There, we discussed that there are about three main views for how to interpret after their kind, and only the fixity of the species interpretation is the only one that's in any serious conflict with the idea of common ancestry or common descent. We also talked a little bit about the contemporary field of evolutionary science and how Darwinism is, that's a big scary word, is actually dead, and it's been dead since like the 1870s. Neo-Darwinism is also dead since like the 1910s. And the modern synthesis is probably on its way out. It's radically incomplete. So we talked about some of the newer, more contemporary theories that are on the field that are starting to supplement this idea of random mutation and natural selection. That's what we mean by the modern synthesis. Those causal factors are definitely true, but contemporary field has kind of agreed, the consensus is that they're insufficient to explain everything. And because of that, a lot of the debates about creation and evolution are kind of stuck in the past. They're still debating things that modern scientists have already kind of said, yeah, we know that that's insufficient. What we're going to talk about this week is Adam and Eve. And these are the scientific and theological battlegrounds that we talked about. So those first three questions is what we discussed last week. And we left the fourth one off for this week because of the theology. And last week we kind of said, you know, these first three things, the age of the earth, common descent, mechanisms of biological diversity, they're interesting. They can cause tensions with certain interpretations, but broadly speaking, nobody really loses their marbles over this. It's not that big of a deal theologically. But once you start talking about human beings and you start talking about Adam and Eve, then things start to get really dicey. These are eight independent doctrinal positions that I thought of just this morning where debates over Adam and Eve at some point come up. Probably the big one is this fancy word, hamartiology. That's a $10 word. The doctrine of sin. Christology, it's, you know, Jesus. Eschatology, it's the end times. Baptism. I know for a fact that in this room there are at least six different views of baptism and whether babies are involved, and all of us are going to start arguing about Adam and Eve at some point in that debate. It even reaches into apologetics and it comes to this idea of theodicy. You know, why is there evil in the world? Why do babies die? That question is literally tied into what you think about Adam and Eve. And of course, the most significant one is anthropology, our doctrine of man. depending on what you think about Adam and Eve and what you think about these stories and how you interpret them, it's going to radically shape what you think about the human race. I will give you one tangent because I think this is particularly relevant. In the 1860s, this was a major theological fight where there were many abolitionist Christians that were motivated by their specific belief that all human beings were descended from Adam and Eve, literally in the strongest sense of that term. Because they believed that, they genuinely believed there was no moral difference between black people, white people, or any other race. And because of that, they fought for abolition on that basis of their belief. And many people that were racist and many people that defended slavery used Darwin at the time and said, look, science backs us up. Because Darwin says that there's not one human race, there are actually like five, and wouldn't you know it, the white race is at the top and the Negroid race is at the bottom. So actually, we were right all along. Sad chapter in human history. And you'll actually still hear this argument come up a lot where people say, oh, if you believe evolution, that makes you a racist. I'd recommend the book, The Civil War is a Theological Crisis. Truth in Advertising, there were some people that were racists and they were Christians. And they said, well, since I'm a racist, I have to square my racist beliefs with Christianity in some way. And started sort of back interpreting things in text because they were running into this question of, well, if everyone descends from Adam and Eve, then how can I still be racist towards black people? And I'm sure some of you have heard this idea of the curse of Ham, literally invented by racists looking for something to be racist about because of their belief in Adam and Eve. We're not going to get into it any further than just this comment right here, but I'd recommend that book, The Civil War is a Theological Crisis. Excellent introductory book. Read the footnotes. Now, what is our goal tonight? Because if we're not going to talk about all of these, so let me just give you an example objection of what some people will typically bring up in a conversation about apologetics. So this is a nice, you know, scholarly meme that I found. So in four sentences, this is going to refute all of Christianity. Genetics has proven the Adam and Eve story in Genesis to be impossible. Without the Adam and Eve story, there would be no, quote, original sin. Without original sin, there would be no need for Jesus. Without Jesus, the Christian religion falls apart completely. The whole religion is based on and relies upon a story that could not possibly be true. All evidence points to this fact. End game. All right, let's go home. We've all been refuted, right? If you just think about this statement for, like, I don't know, 2 seconds, how many hidden assumptions are baked into this? I can think of at least 10 independent assumptions that are all baked into this. So our goal tonight is not to refute this every single, you know, go down the logical tree of every possible objection. Our goal is not to discuss all the possible variations of Adam and Eve and how they interact with those 8 independent Christian doctrines that I talked about. I did the math just before I came up here. That would result in 390,000 independent combinations, dependent at minimum on a conservative estimation. So our goal is not to go through all of these things. Our goal tonight is just to establish the opening move. It's just to say, here's how we start to respond to this. Here's the lay of the land so we know where we're going and the potential routes that we can take. So with that in mind, here's going to be our roadmap. First, we're going to talk about the biblical data of Adam and Eve. And again, we're going to truncate this to just the most relevant stuff. Then we'll talk about some of the scientific data related to human origins. Again, massively truncating that to just the most relevant things. And then we're going to start to integrate some of these different models with our theological concerns. Major disclaimer here. Every one of those doctrines, depending on your view of Adam and Eve, someone's going to call you a heretic. And we're exploring some possibly heretical views tonight. I am not going to endorse any, but just to put everyone at ease, the official Ratio Christi National Incorporated, the people above us, this is their official position regarding this topic. We believe humans were created in the image of God, and that in a discrete historical event, Adam and Eve fell from their good relationship with God through sin. And as a consequence of their sin, there is a divine curse on the whole of creation, and all descendants of Adam became spiritually dead through having an inherited corrupted nature, Christ alone being the exception. Views expressed today are the views either of myself, which I will try to hold back and be objective as possible, or of the authors I am citing. They are not necessarily endorsed by Ratio Christi. They're not necessarily endorsed by Central Church, which is where we are today. Those views are independent. At this point, I would like to say my Darwin shirt is, for legal reasons, ironic. I'm not necessarily endorsing this. Okay. Recommended resource for you. A lot of the material that we've done here and kind of condensed and structured is based actually on this young up-and-coming man, William Lane Craig. He's got a podcast called Defenders, and he has a 35-episode excursus on creation of life and biological diversity. I don't necessarily agree with all of his conclusions, but excellent resource. And so if you don't see a citation, it's probably coming from this or somewhere in there. I try to be good about my sources, but this is primarily what I'm drawing from. Now, we're going to talk about the biblical Adam and Eve. But before we do that, we've got to make some very important distinctions here. So the first distinctions are we need to talk about a literary character versus a historical character, truth in a story versus truth simpliciter, or unqualified truth, and we need to talk about illustrative uses and assertive uses. All right, so this first one is literary versus historical characters. Human beings have written a lot of narratives and a lot of stories and created a lot of literary works, and they have characters in them. Some of those characters have reference in the real world. When we talk about a character in a story, we're talking about that character insofar as they inhabit the world of their story. When we talk about a historical character, we're actually talking about the flesh and blood human being that actually existed in our world. I think the best way to distinguish between these is a literary character does not have any causal influence on you. Whereas people in the historical world, they inhabit the same causal realm that we do. So a couple of examples. Julius Caesar. There's the historical Julius Caesar, first emperor of the Roman Empire. And then there's also the literary Julius Caesar, the character in the Shakespeare play. More contemporary example. There is Alexander Hamilton, the literal historical first Treasury Secretary of the United States. And then there's Lin-Manuel Miranda in his musical called Hamilton. So whenever we talk about Hamilton, we need to be clear. Are we talking about the musical? Are we talking about the historical person? Whereas Sherlock Holmes, there is no Sherlock Holmes in the real world, but there is a literary Sherlock Holmes. So that's the distinction. Some are purely literary, some are historical and literary, some are purely historical. Pretty straightforward. Now this next one is truth simpliciter, or truth unqualified, versus truth in a story. Unqualified simpliciter truth is just, it's true. No qualifications, no notes, no nothing. Whereas true in a story is, it's true in that story, but it's not true outside of that story. I think a simple example is with Sherlock Holmes. Where does Sherlock Holmes live? Well, literally in the real world, nowhere, because he doesn't exist. But in the story, he lives at 221B Baker Street. So then the last one is illustrative uses versus assertive uses. So illustrative uses is whenever you employ, this is a third party, some other individual, employs a part of the narrative or a part of the history of a particular individual to make a point. Classic example with Julius Caesar. Well, guys, at this point in our proposal, we've crossed the Rubicon. You know, we've reached the point of no return. That is an illustrative use of Julius Caesar. Now, I can say that, and it could be the case that Julius Caesar never existed, or more accurately, he only existed within the Shakespeare play, and that statement would still hold water, right? Because we can use illustrations that are false. Trojan horses, for example, or Pandora's box, you know, anything from Greek mythology, we use it all the time. Whereas if I'm giving you a history of Rome and say, at the point that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, this was an effective declaration of war on Pompey, I think is how his name is actually pronounced. It was the point of no return. Rome was officially in a civil war. So in the first case, an illustration really just needs that literary character. An assertive needs that historical character. So now what we're going to do is, as we survey the biblical data on Adam and Eve, our questions are going to be, are we talking about literary Adam, or are we talking about historical Adam? Are we talking about truth in a story, or are we talking about truth unqualified? Are the authors that reference Adam using him illustratively or assertively? These are the primary texts where Adam and Eve are referenced in the Bible. We're just going to focus on these because these are the most significant. The first is the literary Adam. This is the narrative account of Adam and Eve from Genesis 2 through 4. And I'm going to assume a little bit of familiarity on everyone's part with this story. But broadly speaking, God creates this man out of dirt. He breathes in him the breath of life. He names a bunch of animals. He gets lonely. God cuts him in half or takes out a rib. It's kind of not clear. He creates a woman, names her Eve. They're married. They rebel against God. They're kicked out of the Garden of Eden. They have a bunch of kids, namely Cain and Abel. And then they kind of disappear from the picture for a while. So this is actually what defines the literary Adam. When we say literary Adam, we're talking about this character in Genesis 2 through 4. And a genre analysis of Genesis 1 through 11, again from about 2 weeks ago, suggests that this account is mythohistory. In other words, it's probably talking about the past. It's probably talking about real events. But it's so cloaked in this sort of mythological language that we really can't be too certain about what the boundary is between literal, straightforward, factual history and sort of, you know, literary license, if you will. One example that I think makes this point well is the very names Adam and Eve. Adam is itself a Hebrew word meaning man, and Eve is, translations are debated, but it's usually referred to as something like life. So if you read it in English, God created man and life. You already kind of see that this isn't really like a straightforward story. And more importantly, those puns, those are Hebrew puns that really only make sense after the fact. The Hebrew from about 1000 BC is what you would need in order for these puns to make sense. So the story itself, if it was actually given to Adam and Eve in the time when they were created, even if you do 4000 BC, it wouldn't have made sense to them. It doesn't make sense in any language except, you know, monarchical Hebrew. What is the summary here? So this narrative account is not really clear on its own. The most we can infer confidently is that we're talking about truth in a story, we're talking about a literary character, possibly historical, but nothing in the text itself as it stands really demands anything past that in and of itself. Now the second character is the genealogical Adam. This is when Adam shows up in genealogies throughout the Bible. There are three of them. So Genesis 5, of course, you know, that's Adam's children. 1 Chronicles 1 recounts the genealogies of Genesis 5 and ties it into the monarchy. And then, of course, Luke 3 references Adam at the very end of, or rather the very beginning of Jesus' own genealogy. These genealogies include people that are undoubtedly historical, or at least intended to be historical at the very minimum. David, Jesus, Moses. More importantly, the mythological oddities that are in these lists, for example, the really, really long ages, those are not sufficient to say that they're not historical. So the Sumerian king list, as a point of, as an example here, it's a list of all the kings of Sumer. Surprise, right? I don't remember exactly when it was written. I think maybe 1500 BC. But it lists these kings reigning for like tens of thousands of years. But if you look at this one king who's I'm going to mess up the name. Enmebarageshi. This guy reigned for 900 years, according to the Sumerian king list. But here's a little potsherd right over here, or an illustration of it. This guy like was real. He was undoubtedly an actual king. Saying, oh well, obviously, you know, he lived for 900 years. This is a mythological character. That's not going to cut it. Now, truth in advertising. Sumerian scholars actually debate over the kings prior to Enmebarageshi as to whether or not they were historical. So you could really go either way on this. You can say, since Enmebarageshi is a real person, the kings prior to him are probably real. Or you could say, well, since the people prior to Enmebarageshi aren't real, then we know that we can tack purely mythological people in with real people. And the general attitude of scholarship is to lean towards people in genealogies are given the benefit of the doubt as being real people, like actual historical people. And I think that at least for Genesis 5, 1 Chronicles, and Luke, the benefit of the doubt is being given to Adam as being a historical person. So that's the genealogical Adam. And the last Adam is, of course, the Pauline Adam. This is the one where everyone gets all their marbles in a wad. First, let me make a meta comment. I just talked about Genesis 2 and 1 Chronicles 1, and that is it. That's all Adam is in the Old Testament. There may be like a handful of odd references, but all of them are debatable. Like, that's the only time he's non-controversially in the Old Testament. But he gets way more attention in the New Testament. Paul talks about him quite a bit, and the three most significant ones are this one, this incidental remark in Acts 17. For context, Paul is in Athens, right? Thank you. So he's in Athens. He's on Mars Hill. He's arguing with a bunch of pagans. He's making all these illustrations. He's making a bunch of points, and he's arguing. And then he makes this comment, God made from one every nation of men to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation. Now, the majority of interpreters consider this the one to be Adam. Some translations will render this God made from one man every nation of men. So this is at least an incidental affirmation that Paul definitely believed in the universal descent of humanity from Adam. But in the context, Paul is making a lot of references and allusions to a lot of different sources. In fact, in this very discourse, he references pagan material. Definitely didn't think that it was inspired. If he throws in his own Hebrew scriptures as an example, I don't think that we can really infer much more than that this is a primarily an illustrative point. And for that reason, I don't think we can really assign much more than the literary Adam, at least in this part. It can go either way, but I tend to think that this is an illustrative use. The second passage doesn't quite give us that out. So 1 Corinthians 15, this is Paul's commentary on the resurrection. Excellent passage. And he starts drawing these parallels, poignant theological parallels between Christ and Adam. For as by one man came death, by a man has also come the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. Thus it is written, the first man Adam became a living being, the last man Adam, that is Christ, became a life-giving spirit. Just as we bear the image of the man in dust, we shall also bear the image of the man in heaven. Paul clearly thought that Jesus was a real historical person who really literally exists. So trying to draw these parallels starts to really blur the lines between, is it a literary character, Adam, and a historical person, Jesus? Well, the Greek technically allows that, because Paul's argument, or the Greek here, doesn't really say, like, because of one man's sin, therefore Jesus, at least not in this passage. So it could go either way, but think about it for a minute. Think about what Paul's argument here is, and think, is it really that natural to think that he's using a purely literary character to make his argument? This one, I think, goes on the question mark pile. I could go either way on this one, honestly. But the last passage here, Romans 5, this is where things really get dicey if you're going to say that Adam is just a literary character. Paul actually intensifies these Adam-Christ parallels. And most significantly, he says, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. For as by the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. At this point, Adam is really starting to be used as a causally relevant agent in the world in which we inhabit. And at that point, I think this passage at least really pushes past the boundary of the literary Adam, and now we're starting to need more of a historical Adam. I think this is the single strongest passage to say that Paul at least affirmed a historical Adam. Truth in advertising. This is my own assessment. This is the assessment of a lot of evangelicals, which, again, that's my tradition. There are many other interpreters who do not agree with that. There are some interpreters who say that Paul's argument doesn't commit you to a historical Adam. My personal assessment? I don't find them all that persuasive. So let's summarize real quick. First, we have the narrative account of Genesis 2 through 4 that defines the literary Adam. But the genre that we're talking about, this complicated mytho-proto-history, it really tempers down any strong historical inferences based on just that text alone. But the genealogies of Genesis 5, those suggest a historical interest in Adam and seem to assert Adam at least at the genealogical headwaters of all of humanity. And then Paul's incidental treatment in Acts and 1 Corinthians, their most natural interpretation is that he is a historical person. Paul employs him both illustratively and assertively. Romans 5 really seems to be a direct, positive, assertive argument that Adam is responsible for things in our world that a mere literary character cannot. Now, there are a lot of different models for Adam and Eve, which we'll talk about in just a second, but let me just pause right here and see if there are any questions or comments.
I was wondering if there were any significant differences between the Septuagint version of Adam and the Masoretic text version of Adam.
I think he lived for a different period of time. I think his lifespan was different.
Okay. And if it is in the lifespans, if the difference is in the lifespans,
then it might be some sort of numerical significance that we don't understand anymore.
Dude, okay, so next week we're going to talk about biblical chronology when we talk about the Exodus, and I'm going to talk about that quite a bit to the point where you never want to hear about numbers ever again. But yes, the Septuagint does some goofy things with the genealogy, and nobody knows why. And the question was about the significance of the differences in the numbers between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. Question from the chat. Couldn't the blurring of the lines between what is mythological and historical in Genesis have occurred by Paul's time, like during one of the language shifts during an exile? The blurring of the lines between... So I don't exactly understand this question, but I will say this, which is relevant. So between the closing of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament, we have this period known as the Second Temple period, where the Jewish people returned from exile. They rebuilt their second temple, or they rebuilt their temple, which is the second one, And then it was destroyed in 70 AD, roughly contemporaneous with the New Testament. During that time period, there was a lot of literature, and I mean a ridiculous amount of literature that was generated, an enormous amount of literature called scriptural rewriting, which in modern parlance would just best be categorized as Bible fan fiction, where these people, the Jewish people, were reflecting on the mysterious characters of the Old Testament, in particular Enoch, Adam, and Methuselah. Those were the big three. And they wrote tons of stories about these guys. A lot of speculation was made regarding what their activities were. So there's a thing called the First Book of Enoch, very wild story, where Adam and Methuselah and these guys are involved in a lot of different things in human history. Adam was really used quite a bit in all of these stories to do different theological things, and definitely things that were nowhere attested to in the Hebrew Bible. When you ask this question, could the blurring of historical and mythological lines, the main argument that I think is the most persuasive against the position that I've taken would be to say Paul is in this tradition of Bible fan fiction writing, and he is just using Adam like all of his other contemporaries were. They used them for crazy, wild fan fiction stuff. He's using Adam for the gospel, so that's a much more noble enterprise. That's actually the position of a book we'll talk about later called Adam and the Genome. There's a New Testament scholar who makes this argument. Let's talk about some theological models real quick. So the first one is Adam and Eve are individual biological ancestors of the whole human race. They were either created recently, so like 10,000 years ago, or anciently, like hundreds of thousands of years ago. And they were created as the biological ancestors of the entire human race. This term biological is a major weasel word, which we'll get back to once we talk a little bit about the scientific data. Now, the recent versus ancient comes from our discussion last week where we talked about the age of the earth can go kind of either way. This is not really nailing down a position on that at this time. So the second view is individual representative ancestors. Adam and Eve were a divinely selected pair in a group of human ancestors to federally represent the human race. Oh my goodness, where did this group come from? You're reading into the text. This doesn't exist. This is made up. I am reporting you for Concordism. So, tangent. Did Adam have contemporaries? If Adam and Eve are the only ones at the beginning, then that's going to create major problems. So let's find a way to weasel in other human beings. Historically, this has actually been a legitimate debate. I'm not going to tell you one way or the other what to think about this. A couple of considerations. Genesis 1 tasks human beings to fill the earth and subdue the earth, the entire planet. Whereas Genesis 2 says that human beings, Adam and Eve, are to work and tend the Garden of Eden. No real indication to go outside the garden. So this has caused some people to think maybe there are two separate groups of humans. A big group of humans at the beginning that are told to basically conquer the earth, and a separate, more intimate group, Adam and Eve, to take care of this garden. And so it could be the case that these are two separate events. Of course, the big one that everyone knows is Cain's wife. Where did Cain get his wife, right? Cain has this incident in Genesis 4. He kills his brother. Now he's scared of other people. He takes his wife and he goes builds a city. There has been so much speculation on where his wife came from, who he's afraid of, and who he built the city with. And so some people suggest, oh, well, there were just other people around. The Bible just didn't talk about him. So there are two solutions here, two possible solutions that have been brought up. The first one is Genesis 1 has an en masse creation of human beings, so you have a whole bunch of human beings that show up, and then later Adam and Eve are selected from that group for a special revelation of God. The other suggestion is the exact inverse, where you have Adam and Eve, they show up as the first humans on the scene, and then they're banished, and then the other human beings just sort of show up, but they're not necessarily descended from Adam and Eve. Both of these views have been defended historically in Christianity and Judaism. The whole point of that tangent was just to say there's at least precedent exegetically for the existence of human beings outside of Adam and Eve, either before them or contemporaneous with them. Okay, so we've got our individual biological ancestors. We now have the individual representative ancestors. So they're individuals that are selected, but they represent a group. The other is the inverse of that. There's a group representation. So God creates a group, and then these just happen to be, Adam and Eve happen to be the most prominent ones. And then the last one is just to say there is no Adam and Eve. They're just purely literary characters, and that's it. So broadly speaking, we have individual biological ancestors. We have representatives as a part of a group. Or we have that they are just these literary characters and that's it. Okay? So let's tie a bow, put that on the shelf, and let's look at some scientific data. Now, full transparency here, I am not an evolutionary biologist. I'm not a geneticist. I have never looked at a strand of DNA since 10th grade whenever I did a lab in biology class. So, massive caveat to what I'm about to say. Now, there are two major claims whenever it comes to this debate over Adam and Eve and population genetics and what have you. The first one is the claim of common ancestry. So I'll state it exactly as is. Modern human beings, that is Homo sapiens, share a common ancestor with other primates, chimpanzees, for example. The second claim is that the ancestral population of human beings has never been lower than a few thousand people. So another way to say that is, if you go back in time, you'll reach these genetic bottlenecks. Well, there have definitely been near extinction events. The human population has gotten real small. It's never gone down to two. It's always been at least 3 to 10,000. So let's look at this first one. Do human beings share a common ancestor with chimpanzees? So here's the claim. So evolutionary theory predicts that the genomes that we observe in living primates are in fact modified forms of an original genome that was present in the common ancestor of those species. And there are four main lines of evidence. The first one is the similarity of the gene sequencing. So another way of saying that is genetic homology. And that actually goes all the way down to the amino acid level and even the nucleotide level. So it's a very, and I'll show you an example in a minute what I mean by that. The second one is what's called syntony. Syntony is the view that not only are these genes performing the same functions, they're in the exact same order. They don't necessarily have to be in the same order on the chromosome, but they are in the same order, which is kind of weird. The last two are historical evidences. So pseudogenes, genes that are no longer functional in our genome, they don't do anything. They don't contribute to fitness. They're just there, and yet they're shared between chimpanzees and human beings. So let me give you an example here. This is from a great paper by Dennis Venema called Genesis and the Genome, where he surveys basically all of the evidence and then starts to make some theological applications in the space of like 10 pages. It's a great paper. And so this right here, to interpret this as best I can, so this is just the first line of the nucleotide coding sequence for pre-proinsulin. And the important thing is that these letters here on the left represent Homo sapiens, pan troglodytes, chimps, gorillas, and then some more primates. And if you read it this way, and the black letters indicate a difference between whatever this line is and the human line, or the Homo sapien line. So you can notice, just this is like a really small snippet, but there's a lot of similarity there. And here's what's really significant. If you look down here, these numbers tell you how many different ways, this right here tells you how many codons could be used to code for this particular output. Case in point, I believe this is alanine right here. There are four different ways that you can actually code for alanine. All six of these species have the exact same way that they're doing it, which is really weird. Perhaps an analogy would be if you think that someone's plagiarized a paper, and it turns out that every adjective that they use, whenever there are thousands of synonyms, they happen to use the same adjectives every single time. That's a little suspicious, right? So especially with these cases. So, you know, there are six ways to code this, and they all happen to be exactly the same. Like we mentioned last week, perhaps the single strongest piece of evidence are these endogenous retroviruses. Viruses in the past, sometimes what will happen is that they will infect a host organism, and whenever they do that, they actually inject their own DNA into the body, or I guess it would be RNA. But in any event, these viruses inject their genetic code into a germ cell, such as a sperm or an egg. That little line of code will then actually be propagated all the way down to whatever that organism's progeny happens to be. So if you look here, these are retroviruses that are inserted, and they're shared by pretty much all mammals. So HERVL, this is human endogenous retrovirus. The particular one is L. Don't know what that means, in all honesty. But this is shared between human beings all the way over here, and pretty much all these mammals have this particular endogenous retrovirus. And you can see that all of these retroviruses are shared along all of these different mammals, including primates and most notably chimpanzees. Again, these are inserted into human genome historically. Like, they're not actually generated by us. It's an event in the past that is then propagated to our progeny. So it's very strange if you want to say that they were designed to look that way. This is very peculiar. So critique of common ancestry. Like we talked about last week, the main response is common design. And I'm just going to be honest with you that I think that common design works in principle for these functional regions. You can definitely say, yeah, well, of course the different codons are all coding the same way. God didn't want to make them any different. you know, ain't broke, don't fix it. But why? Why the endogenous retroviruses? This to me is just a mystery. I have not encountered a good response to this. Maybe there is one, but I haven't encountered it, in all honesty.
The fact that there are six different ways or four different ways to code for the same protein, which would presumably do the same thing, also suggests that it's not just common design.
Well, I mean, so the question was about if there's, you know, six ways to skin a cat, why are you all using the same way? Well, I mean, I don't know. I could see either way on that. I mean, I reuse a lot of my own designs whenever I design stuff, even though I don't have to. Efficiency, but then that's going to run into your theodicies when you say God's not efficient because, you know, why make a big universe? He's not efficient. He's an artist. It's. I don't understand. Again, the endogenous retrovirus, that's the one that keeps making me, that's the one that keeps me up at night, if you will. One other comment on this, there are a lot of intelligent design advocates that really don't care about if Adam and Eve have genetic ancestry that shared with the primates and other life on Earth. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I believe this is as an acceptable view in the Catholic Church as well. The Catholics in the room can correct me on that. Okay, I'm correct. So, there we go. So common design, or not common design, sorry, common ancestry or shared ancestry with primates doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. Or at least, you know, if you say that Adam and Eve were made from pre-existing stuff or something, I don't know exactly what it is, but this doesn't seem to be that significant. Now, this other one does seem to be more significant, and that is the ancestral population of human beings has never been lower than a few thousand. Because it's one thing to say, well, maybe Adam and Eve showed up and there were a monkey's uncle or something like that, but everyone after them was a human. No, not if you say they had thousands of other people around them. This is where things start to get dicey. So let me just quote here. This is Dennis Venema that wrote that article that I referenced earlier. This is Adam and the Genome. I recommend this book not as, or purely educational purposes, not an endorsement, purely educational. So here's what he says. As our methodology becomes more sophisticated and more data are examined, we will likely revise our estimates in the future. He's talking about population sizes. That said, we can be confident that finding evidence that we were created separately from other animals, or that we descend only from two people, just isn't going to happen. Some ideas in science are so well supported that it is highly unlikely that new evidence will substantially modify them. Among these, the sun is at the center of our solar system, humans evolved, and we evolved as a population. Why think this? So quick biology review. This is actually more for me than it is for you. All right, this is a chromosome, and this is an allele. And as I'm sure you all remember from your Punnett squares, that you have homozygous and heterozygous. Big A, little a, big A, little a, et cetera, and all that good stuff. An allele frequency is usually what is defined as evolution. Whenever you have a population, an allele frequency changes over time. This is usually what we mean by evolution. So keep this in mind whenever we talk about alleles and chromosomes and whatnot. Okay, here's the main four reasons that people think we evolved from a population. The first one is just the multiplicity of alleles. There are just way too many of them to have originated from two people. The second one is the effect of population estimates, and that has to do with the way this stuff is calculated. We'll talk about that in a minute. Another one is transspecies variation. Again, we'll talk about that in a minute. And the second one is the divergence of alleles, which is there may be a bunch of them, but they may be close together. So it's not that big a deal. But divergence of alleles says that there's actually a large mutational distance between the alleles that are here. Again, that distance is hard to traverse if you just originate from two people. So as promised, we'll talk about these two in a little bit more detail. These are phylogenetic trees for human beings, chimpanzees, and gorillas. So H, C, and G. Tree A right here, this is the species tree. So biologists believe that human beings had a common ancestor with humans, chimps, and gorillas. Human-chimp line diverged from the gorilla line a long time ago, and then more recently, humans and chimps had a common ancestor. There's a hypothetical time axis up and down right here. What you'll notice on this other line, on this center one, this is actually a gene tree. So there are sections of our DNA that do not necessarily line up with chimpanzees. So you would think that if we in fact shared common ancestry with a chimpanzee much earlier than a gorilla, then our DNA and our genome would be basically identical to a chimpanzee with a couple of variations. If you look at a gorilla genome, that, you know, would be much more divergent than it is from the chimpanzee. I don't know if that's making a lot of sense. But the simple thing is that sometimes the wires get crossed. In other words, there are sections of our DNA that is closer to a gorilla than it is to a chimpanzee. In other words, the line of descent gets blurred. And so the hypothesis here is that with this type of variation, that really all of these divergent lines, all of these gene divergent lines, are not going back to nice, neat, clean speciation events, but they're rather going back to a massive ancestral population that had enormous amounts of variation, and that all of these lines were then preserved throughout the different species. I don't know if that really, I don't know if y'all are tracking with me or not. I'm kind of barely tracking with myself, to be honest with you. But broadly, what it's saying is that variations between the species cannot be attributed to nice, neat, clean, you know, divergence events. In any event, that is just to say that one way you can calculate the effective population size is to go back and look for how big of a population is necessary in order to get it on that assumption. You assume that humans, chimps, and gorillas all went back to a giant population. You assume that all that variation that we observe today is present in that population. You do some really complicated math, and then you get, you know, spit out a number. We'll actually talk about the math in a little bit more detail in a second. If you didn't track with that, that's fine. I barely did. Here's Venema's conclusion, which is taken individually and collectively, again, those four lines of evidence we talked about, population genomics strongly suggests that our lineage has not experienced an extreme population bottleneck in the last 9 million years, and any bottlenecks our lineage did experience were a reduction only to a population of several thousand breeding individuals. And as such, the hypothesis that humans are genetically derived from a single ancestral pair in the recent past has no support from a genomics perspective, and indeed is counter to a large body of evidence. In other words, you have to answer this question. If we only came from two people, then why are there sections of our DNA that agree more with a gorilla's DNA than it does even with a chimpanzee's DNA? Critiques for population estimates. This guy right here, Joshua Swamidas, very interesting man. Got to meet him earlier this year. Computational biologist at University of Washington in St. Louis. He does this stuff for a living, and he does math for a living. And he has basically taken Venema's arguments to task, and there are three main critiques that he has of Venema's arguments. The first one is what he calls the window fallacy, which is when we're talking about this breeding group of individuals, we're not talking about a snapshot in time, like, oh, this is, you know, exactly how many people were present at this time. It's a moving average. What these population geneticists are really calculating is saying, on average, that population could never really get below a certain threshold. But it's certainly consistent with ups and downs throughout that time period. And so he says they don't account for special events. Like, they don't account for unique events. They're only talking about averages over time. So the hypothesis of a genetic bottleneck of two really hasn't been tested. All we've said is that on average, there was never really a period of, you know, a couple hundred years or so where it was two. But the Bible doesn't even claim that in the most strict terms. In the most strict terms, Adam and Eve, there were two of them, and they immediately had children, and they immediately had children, and they immediately had children. So even on the strictest terms, this was not even what's being claimed by the Bible. Now, the second one is the ecological fallacy, which I don't know why he called it this, but this is probably the more poignant one. The data that's indicated by population genetics is that the ancestral population of Homo sapiens, on average, never dipped below a few thousand. That is not the same as the population of Homo sapiens never bottlenecked to two. So think about that for a minute. He's saying our ancestors, you know, the genetic pool that we're drawing from is definitely bigger than two, but that doesn't mean that our species at one point could not have been two. In fact, he says, tongue-in-cheek, at one point it was zero. So obviously it can dip below several thousand because at one point there were zero Homo sapiens, and then there were a bunch of Homo sapiens, and if, let's say, for, you know, 50 years, there were two of them. Is that contradictory? No, it's totally consistent with the evidence. And the last one is what I call the genetic fallacy. It's not the genetic fallacy, it's the genetic fallacy. And this is where things start to get really spicy. So he says, look, one of the fundamental assumptions of population genetics is wrong because you're calculating to the most recent common ancestor of a DNA segment. But that is not actually what you're needing to calculate. Because he says, if you think about it, recall from our brief biology lesson, you have on a chromosome in an allele, you basically have four variations for any given allele. Big A, little a, big B, little b, for example. And if you're heterozygous, then that means that you have a full copy of big A, a full copy of little a, and your partner would have a full copy of big B, a full copy of little b, et cetera, et cetera. So what he's saying is what we need to calculate. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the genetic ancestors of all human beings were fully heterozygous. In other words, they had a full, complete copy of one allele, a full complete copy of another allele, and their partner had exactly the opposite, and there were no duplications or anything like that. Let's assume that for the case. What we're really calculating is not the time to the most recent common ancestor, or even to the population size that we're looking for. What we're really looking for is the time to the most recent four alleles. Because if we calculate the time to the most recent four alleles, that will tell us who's responsible for all of the genetic variation that we have in humanity today. Now, this can be falsified if on any particular locus in your chromosome you have more than four alleles. Swaminathan claims that's not the case. He says that actually there's really only a maximum of four. Full honesty, I have no idea if he is correct on that. But that's what he claims, so we'll go with it. And so he says if we calculate the time to the most recent four alleles, we do a bunch of math, and we actually find that a single pair bottleneck is completely consistent with our genetic evidence, so long as it happens 500,000 years ago. Now, that's actually kind of interesting. And if you want to read the math, I encourage you to go to this link where he's actually taking a bite at Venema, because it's his website, peacefulscience.org. It's called Heliocentric Certainty Against a Bottleneck of Two. I highly recommend you read it. See if you can understand it better than I can. But that's the basic top line summary. The hypothesis that you have two fully heterozygous heterozygous ancestors that 500,000 years ago, there's nothing to rule out. There's no evidence against a convergence of a bottleneck of two 500,000 years ago. That's his main takeaway. What did Venema say to this? So last year, he wrote a blog post. Based on new simulations and some other published studies that we drew upon, our group came to an agreement. If an event like this had happened, i.e. a bottleneck of two people, we would be able to detect it if it happened more recently than 500,000 years ago. That was surprising to me, to be sure. I thought beforehand an event like that would show up even further back in time. Basically, he's saying, once you get past 500,000 years, there's no way to rule this out. The evidence just isn't there. Now, in true form, he says, hear me well. There's zero positive evidence that any event such as this actually occurred. And I think he's actually right. All of these simulations that Swaminathan and some of their other colleagues were doing, they are entirely motivated by this hypothesis that they're committed to a single ancestral pair from which all of humanity originated. There's no positive evidence. But what it does do is it says that original claim that there never was a bottleneck, that has been overstated. And I think that's a very significant find. And for Venema to at least admit that much, I think is also pretty significant. Let's do an evaluation. Individual biological ancestry. Scripture says that's the most natural reading of the text, although we've got some mystery characters like Cain's wife. We don't know what to do with them. This could potentially be contradicted by population genetics depending on where you put them in the timeline. Okay? Group version number one, it resolves some of the background character tension. Okay, Cain got his wife because she was part of this wider population. It also fits with some other interesting textual things that we don't have time for. But with the science, again, it's a group of people, so you can put them basically anywhere you want in the timeline, so long as it makes sense. And broadly speaking, this is compatible with population genetics. Group version number two, look, there's no serious indication in the Bible that God actually created a group of people in the Garden of Eden. It's just not there. And I think this is eisegesis, frankly. But again, with the science, nothing really ruled it out scientifically. Now, pure literary characters, obviously they're compatible with science because they don't make any scientific claims. But with Scripture, can purely literary characters actually bear the weight of Paul's theology? I'm not 100% convinced that they can. What we see here is that the biological ancestry is under severe tension. It seems to be under severe tension with the population genetics. But as we talked about, as long as Adam and Eve lived 500,000 years ago, doesn't seem to be any problem with affirming the full natural view. There's definitely some tension with the groups. Views, because again, if you put them back at like 6,000 years ago, that's probably not going to work out. If you put them back a couple hundred thousand years ago, there's no way to say one way or the other.
So, I'm not sure if it's the same, but do you know about Engager's argument about there being an ancestral pair? And I think she was using population genetics. Is it similar to Swaminathan's argument?
Yes. So the question was about Ann Gager. So Ann Gager is a fellow at the Discovery Institute, and she does some other stuff too. So whenever Venema here was talking about our group up here, our group consists of Dennis Venema, Ann Gager, a guy named Richard Bugs, Swaminathan, and like five other people that I don't remember. She actually does not affirm common ancestry, whereas Swamidas does. So her argument, as long as this other guy, I forget what his name is, they were the ones that came up with this 500,000-year-ago convergence on two people view. Swamidas was the one who contributed the most recent four alleles thing. You know, they get married and have a baby, which is this weird view that ultimately Venema admits is not impossible.
It seems like if we are pushing the timeline back 500,000 years ago, it seems we lose the ability to say anything historically significant about the individuals Adam and Eve.
Yeah, that is a very good point. So the question was, or the comment rather, was about if we accept this and say Adam and Eve positively lived 500,000 years ago, that's going to severely diminish a lot of our claims about them historically. Because the Bible, you know, these stories are written, depending on your view, 1200 BC to 500 BC. So you're talking about literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years transpiring for this narrative before you get to it. I actually have a comment at the very end about that.
Major holes in any genealogy.
That is exactly right. Very good point. Yeah, so the comment was about the genealogy. So your genealogies, we mentioned last week, you can definitely telescope genealogies. This happens all the time. Happens in the Bible. Jesus' genealogy is compressed down to 14 people, three sets of 14. Way more people were involved. So you would have to say that you have from 500,000 BC-ish all the way up to Abraham, who's probably 1500 BC, you have that compressed all the way down into a single chapter. It's not impossible, but it's front-loaded. In other words, you basically have, well, I have like a whole developed thing on this. It's at the very end of the presentation, though. Basically, you have Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel, 500,000 years, Lamech, more or less how that goes. And then Lamech says, well, wait, I know Cain, you know, because he says if Cain's anger is sevenfold, let Lamech's be 77-fold. So where are these gaps supposed to be? I don't know. And that's where you have to lean on the mytho-historical interpretation to just say, this is a compressed account of human history. I actually have some specific comments on this in a minute, but are there any other comments on this survey right here?
Dr. Craig wants to push it back to 750,000. I just saw him say that today.
Oh, yeah, I have a thing on that, too. Yeah. Okay. Well, so we're short on time, but I want to buzz through really, really quickly on this idea. I want to talk about biological ancestry. So far, we have been talking just about this question, which is genetic progenitorship. But what we just mentioned was the Bible doesn't have anything about genetics in it. It has genealogies, right? And then the second question, which is when did Adam and Eve live? So far, what we're talking about is if we assume they're the sole genetic progenitors of the entire human race, scientifically, unless we dispute the science, unless we, you know, pull out our own calculators and do population genetics ourselves, we're looking at 500,000 years ago. But is that the only way to take biological ancestry? So let me look at this real quick. I'm going to buzz through this super fast. Swamidas does not actually accept the view that he was just defending. He just says population genetics is fake news. Well, it's not fake news. It's just overstated. Here's an interesting insight. When you talk about genetic ancestry, your genetic ancestry dilutes as you go further back in time. So think about this. You have half of your father's DNA. You have 25% of your grandfather's DNA. You have 12.5% of your great-grandfather's DNA. You don't have to go back more than about 10 generations, and you're talking about someone who is you are the direct descendant of somebody who has effectively 0% of their DNA is present in your genome. Is genetics really the most reliable guide to discovering our ancestry and our relationships? And like I said, this is a very weird way. Like, we're used to it because we're 50 years past Barbara McClintock's discovery of DNA, which was then stolen by Francis Crick and all those guys. But, you know, conversation for a different time. But the world, looking at the world through a DNA lens is very new. The more ordinary definition is genealogy. And genealogy has the opposite effect of genetics. It actually compounds. So consider this. You have one father, and you have two grandfathers, you have four great-great-grandfathers, you have eight grandfathers, et cetera, et cetera. It goes up exponentially as you go further back in your family tree. I know it's late, but follow me here on the math. If you're going exponentially up in your family tree as you're going backwards in time, but the real population of human beings goes down exponentially as we go back in time, we're headed towards a convergence where basically everyone's genealogies is eventually, almost by mathematical necessity, they're going to have to overlap at some point. and you're eventually going to have a point where people all have the same great-great-great-great-grandfather. So this is what Swamidas argues in his book, The Genealogical Adam and Eve. And he says, we need to look at this through the lens of genealogical science and not the lens of genetic science. Because if we look at it genetically, we're not going to get any sensible answers. And so basically, this is what he's arguing for. He says, Adam and Eve, if we assume that there are genetic ancestors from 10,000 years ago, obviously not everyone's related to them. The population genetics works at 10,000 years. There's no way that this is true. Like he was saying, the traditional account, you know, the biblical traditional account is that everyone on earth is descended from Adam and Eve. And so his synthesis of this is Adam and Eve were created 10,000 years ago, and as it turns out, through the necessity of genealogical ancestry and whatnot, it turns out that every person on the face of the earth shares an ancestor at 10,000 years. And he says, why don't we just use the Bible and supplement our knowledge there and say it's Adam and Eve. Bingo, bango, bongo, done, right? And ta-da. We now have found something that's compatible with the traditional account and compatible with the mainstream science account and actually respects the text for what it is, mainly a genealogical account of human origins, not a genetic account of human origins. So there are two ways of answering this question of biological ancestry, genetically and genealogically. So if we say that genetic ancestry is important for whatever our theological reasons may be, we're pretty much committed to a 500,000 year ago Adam and Eve. If we say that Adam and Eve are our genealogical ancestors, we have the freedom to say they existed 10,000 years ago or earlier. Obviously, if they were past 10,000 years ago, they're still our genealogical ancestors. So now the question is, how do you answer this? One last run through on these, and then we'll wrap up real quickly. So individual biological ancestors, our objection is, this is contradicted by population genetics. Well, genealogical ancestry converges at about 6 to 10,000 years ago, whereas genetic ancestry converges at 500,000 years ago. So we've kind of done away for the most part with this objection. Again, scripture, this seems to be the most natural reading. So as long as you're willing to bite the bullet and say they lived 500,000 years ago, it seems like you're fine. We talk about the individual group ancestors. Again, they're compatible on depending on the timeline. So put them at 200,000 years ago to account for the oldest human remains, and you're fine. Put them back older, doesn't matter. Again, this genealogical ancestry kicks in at about 10,000 years, so your theology is good anywhere older than 6,000 years. Our only tensions that are left now are with scripture. They're not actually with the scientific data for the most part. This is kind of where I think Swamidas's contributions, this book came out just last year, and I really think that they haven't really percolated all the way down, because I think this is a pretty significant argument. It goes a long way to resolving the Adam and Eve debate. A lot of people just flat out reject anything to do with evolution because I need Adam and Eve in my theology. And if Swamidas, if his book is correct, he says you can accept all of evolution, you can accept even the worst forms of evolution, like neo-Darwinism, and it doesn't affect this theology. And I think that's a very significant argument. Now, transparency, I don't agree with him on everything, but I think that's still pretty significant. So let's wrap up here. So are Adam and Eve in conflict with population genetics? Probably not. The only way they're going to be in conflict is if you assume both the Bible is discussing genetic ancestry and if that genetic ancestor is more recent than 500,000 years ago. Now, the second question is, what are the views of Adam and Eve that are theologically permissible for what we need Christian theology to do? And like we've said, we've been going over the spectrum of views that broadly you've got individual biological ancestors, you have important people in a group, and you have literary characters. And so there are multiple views, and most of them are not really going to be sorted out by the science. Like we said, depending on the flavor you take, there are definitely versions of each one that are compatible with science, even compatible with full-scale evolutionary accounts of human origins. So it's really going to come down to the secondary theological considerations. Now, by secondary, I do not mean secondary in importance, but secondary in inference. We've only been talking thus far about the raw biblical data. But once you start synthesizing the data into a theological system, you know, secondary inferences, then you're going to have to reevaluate that list of questions. What exactly are Adam and Eve doing in my theology? If I'm committed to a particular view of original sin, for example, that original sin started with Adam and it is literally propagated, in some sense biologically, to his progeny, I'm going to have to accept that he's the genetic ancestor of the human race, for example. Another question I think is very significant is the nature of the image of God. So William Lane Craig, guy all the way at the beginning, this is actually his reasoning for where Adam and Eve go. So he adheres to a view of the image of God called structuralism, which means that when we say someone is the image of God, that means it is tied to, it is inherent to, and it is inherited from biology, in a sense. Case in point, brain capacity, capacity for speech, free will, things of that nature. And this is indicated by certain activities. So his argument is there are certain activities, there's significant evidence of other hominin creatures that do significantly interesting things, such as cave drawings or making spears or even tying complicated twine. And so his argument goes, well, you need to be able to do sophisticated reasoning in order to do these things. Therefore, these people, Neanderthals, for example, are in the image of God. If they're in the image of God, they had to have gotten it from Adam and Eve. Therefore, Adam and Eve have to be the ancestors of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. Therefore, Adam and Eve are most likely Homo heidelbergensis, which lived about 750,000 years ago. See that? Now, this reasoning, now notice this reasoning. This is not from the text. It's not from the science. It's from a secondary inference. His specific view of the image of God and how Adam and Eve play a role in that lead to his conclusion Adam and Eve existed 750,000 years ago. And like I said, 8 independent doctrines involve Adam and Eve. So you can literally have upwards of 360,000 different permutations.
And kind of explain why it would be the case that he would so fervently go from that, because then if he said, well, Neanderthals have the image of God, mm-hmm. And they're before Adam and Eve. So, in other words, he's in a quandary, because he can't say that, right?
Yeah, exactly. On his interpretation of the image of God, you cannot have people in the image of God before Adam and Eve. So this is one example. Now, there was a mention earlier about the historical relevance of the narratives. I'm going to show you the flip side of this argument. This is another just example. This is reasoning from the Genesis narratives. So if you read the narratives, and even the theology of like Genesis 1 through 5, the activities described and the theology communicated indicate agrarian society. For example, in Genesis 2, when there was no man to till the earth, that's an agrarian reference. Cain and Abel are, you know, the farmer and the sheep herder. The pun that is made when Cain says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" This is a specific pun based on sheep herding and sheep keeping. Or Cain went east of Eden and built a city. The archaeology says this type of like sheep herding and, you know, animal keeping and agriculture and city building, you know, the typical Settlers of Catan world, archaeologically in the Levant, that's like the Neolithic Revolution, which was 12,000 years ago. You go back 500,000 years ago, you're not going to see cities, you're not going to see sheep pens, you're not going to see altars to gods. You just don't see these types of things. So therefore, if you take these narratives seriously and you take them as actually referring to, in some sense, historical activities, Adam and Eve lived about 10,000 years ago. Make sense? So this is what I'm getting at, right? So this is saying, well, because of my commitment to the image of God, and because of that, I'm going to put Adam and Eve 750,000 years ago so I can have Neanderthals in with the image of God. Another way, well, these narratives indicate agrarian Neolithic farmers, so they're probably, you know, 10 to 12,000 years ago. But that means that we had several hundred thousand years of hominins, you know, Neanderthals and whatnot doing stuff. It's intractable, I think. That's what I mean whenever I say that these are the secondary theological considerations that are going to drive what Adam and Eve are. And all we've discussed so far is just the boundaries of where those things are. I'll just wrap up again on our conclusion slide here. There are a lot of different views that are compatible with the raw biblical data and the scientific data. But it's ultimately going to come down to secondary inferences or secondary theological concerns on where you fall on this issue. And that is going to be a discussion for not now. So next week we're going to end. This concludes our evolution excursus. And next week we are going to talk about Exodus. So what do you all think? So discussion time. So what do you think? This is just a sample, but which of these theological issues do you think are the most significant driving the certain view of Adam or Eve that a person should take?
So as far as the genealogical Adam and Eve it seems probable that there could be multiple genealogical common ancestors, either a set of them at the same period of time, or one individual who's incidentally part of everybody else's, like halfway down the chart. Why do those individuals in everybody's genealogies, why do they have influence or not have influence over everybody else?
Ah, very good question. So the question is, Adam and Eve, so it seems like any contemporary of Adam and Eve, or definitely any of their ancestors, they're also going to be universal genealogical ancestors. So why all this attention to Adam and Eve? An excellent question. It's really simple, though. Why is all the attention given to Abraham as the father of the Hebrews, when obviously his father was also equally the father of the Hebrews? And his father was the father of the Hebrews, just as much as Abraham was. Because God came to Abraham and said, through your loins all the nations will be blessed. God spoke to Abraham in a way that he did not speak to Abraham's father. Likewise, God came to Adam and said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, etc., and had a special, unique relationship with him. That's why he gets all the attention, and it's because of his shenanigans that caused all the problems. Through one man's trespass, Adam's trespass, all these other people were made subject to death. But through one man's righteousness, or dare I say, one man's faith, Abraham, many will be made righteous. There's a good sermon point for you there.
Presumably those people weren't subject to death until Adam entered their ancestry.
Yeah, this is a great question. So I think that this is probably one of the most significant theological questions, which is, what is the relationship of death? How does Adam bring death into the world if for literally hundreds of thousands of years his genetic ancestors were living and dying and of terrible things? Yeah, comment.
I'm going to interject and throw in a view that I don't think has been discussed much in the theology, is that it's commonly assumed that Adam and Eve were in a natural state, that not dying was natural to them in the Garden of Eden, that God created the nature of humanity to be not dead. Mm-hmm. But another way to think about it is to instead assume that, well, maybe they were in a supernatural state, that they were preordained, not as just the the archetypes of the human race, but instead to two people who were given grace by God to be supernatural, so to not die. And with that came along free will and other certain things. So then when they chose against God and they chose death, this was simply bringing them back into the natural state. That this didn't suddenly then make the death of anybody before them or at the same time with them as them evil, but it simply made them no longer in their grace-infused state. They chose against God, so they in particular would have death. And this doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything odd about the other people around them at the same time. The other people around them simply didn't have grace-infused.
This is an excellent point. So the comment is, it seems like Adam and Eve, we're assuming Adam and Eve were created immortal whenever they could have just been created mortal like all of their ancestors before them, and that the tree of life is sort of a gift from God, and so their banishment was being kicked out of the special place where they more or less had access to immortality. I must say I'm very sympathetic to this view, and I think it does make a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Because if you think about it, the punishment for Adam and Eve is not that they're killed dead on the spot. It's that their relationship with God is ruined, first of all, and he withdraws himself. He's no longer present. And the second thing is that they're kicked out of the garden away from the tree of life. Now, metaphorically, the tree of life is widely considered to be, the source of divine goodness and life and whatnot. This is revisited in Revelation whenever John sees the tree of life in the center of the New Jerusalem, because presumably it's a metaphorical image of, resurrection, new life, all that good stuff. And so it totally makes sense that it is not that the curse is more of deprivation than it is of anything else. God just kicks them out of the garden and they die. And presumably if you're an old earth creationist anyway, you're going to be okay with animals dying before this, whatever happens in this garden type place. The problem that I think significantly that you're going to have to deal with then is, it's a question of theodicy, right? Because if you think biologically or anatomically modern humans that had the same brain structures and everything as we have today, that lived before Adam and Eve, that presumably had the same consciousness that we have, that were drawing cave art and self-representation and all that stuff, why are they suffering so much? Why are they in so much pain and suffering and dying and death for literally nothing, right? In fact, Romans 5, Paul makes the argument that that God looked over the trespasses of that time, which some people have interpreted as being the pre-Adamites. God looked over the sins of the pre-Adamites. But why on earth is there so much suffering? And now you've just completely opened yourself up to a new theodicy. And I think it's a significant question. Yeah.
Have you ever read William Dembski's sort of weird...
Yeah. Sort of the pre-fall. Yeah, so again, it's... So the standard argument for animal death is just to say that animals don't suffer in the way humans suffer. So their death is very different from human death. And they don't have a spiritual connection to God anyway, so they don't experience physical death. But when you're talking about anatomically modern humans that are living and dying and presumably suffering, it just seems very difficult to me. And I don't think there's a good answer to that, unless you're going to say that God wanted to... So the one theological reasoning chain could be that, you know, we humans currently live in a fallen world. God intervened with Abraham and then intervened with Jesus, and each of those were kind of elevating human existence in a way that's pointing ultimately to the recreation and restoration of all things. But you would have to basically retroject that and say that, you know, you have all 100,000 years of human, literally, you know, biological humans living and dying and suffering, and then God intervenes with Adam and Eve to, like, elevate creation to the next level. I don't know. It seems ad hoc to me. And to be quite honest, even though I definitely lean, I'll put a little card on the table. I lean towards thinking Adam and Eve probably lived 10,000 years ago. That makes the most sense to me. But I don't know what to do with all the people before them. You know? Yeah.
Just to push back at the problem a bit, I think that it could be argued that under the view that they were raised to a supernatural state, then one could easily say that a natural state isn't inherently evil and that death isn't inherently evil. So,
yeah, you're going to have to take that up with Paul, though, because he's saying death spread to all men because all sinned. That's his argument in Romans 5. And if you say that there are humans that are dying and they're not sinning, or they're dying and sin and it wasn't because of Adam, it's, I don't know. Now, I'll tell you Swami Das's answer, because I asked him about this in our podcast, which I forgot to plug. We interviewed him earlier this year. So who's heard of a philosophical zombie? Anybody heard of these? Okay. So a philosophical zombie, for those of you that aren't familiar, is a person that looks exactly like us, behaves exactly like us, but they have no inner thought life at all. They have no self-awareness. They have no concept of themselves or anything like that. And the argument goes that there's literally no way you can distinguish from these individuals and actual human beings with self-consciousness. There's no way to do it. Swami Das says, well, that's what was going on. You had a bunch of basically biological robots that had no self-consciousness running around. So when they die, it's like they don't have a conscience, so they're not sinning, and they don't have self-awareness, so they're not suffering.
Also fall in with Craig's view that perhaps Adam and Eve do need to be the first with Imago Dei, and so everyone else is philosophical zombies do not have Imago Dei.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's actually part of the argument, is that you cannot distinguish a person, like a person who has an inner thought life, from someone who has all the outward appearance of thought life. That's Swami Das's argument. Swami Das is absurdly wrong, because he missed the point of the thought experiment. It has nothing to do with this. But it's even worse, because that means like Cain married a philosophical zombie. And what happens to his children at that point? Like, what happened? Because that's the whole problem, right? The whole thing is we're supposed to inflate the genetic pool so that we can get the right genetic variants, which means Adam and Eve's children, who were full, true, self-aware human beings, were mating with zombies. Like, he had no answer to this, by the way. I don't think he understood my question either. But anyway, yeah.
So, just to, like, the way this actually may work in what I've read in philosophy is that if you want to say the majority of people are philosophical zombies at some time in the past, you just tweak the definition of consciousness to not include certain activities that people in the past didn't have. So some guy has actually written, his last name is James, a book that argues that the people in the Iliad were unconscious. Mm-hmm. And he does this by, I don't think it's good, but by tweaking the definition of consciousness to say, oh, well, if you have a God appearing to you, that means that it's actually some psychological phenomenon that your brain just isn't firing the right way. And so if all these people have gods appearing to them, that means they weren't conscious, because my definition of consciousness means that your brain has to fire in a specific way.
Yeah.
So that's the way that it seems. Yeah,
it's just an ad hoc model to say, I mean, the way you would get, you know, it's ad hoc. I mean, the way you want to get around it is that God, you know, created a group of special people inside the garden, right? Mm-hmm. So that they, and Adam and Eve are the representatives.
So, I mean, blazing hot take here, 90%. 98% of all arguments about Adam and Eve are blatantly ad hoc. Like, they just are. Like, you know, and it's almost a part of the nature of it. Science can't really rule out two individuals doing things in the distant past. What it can do is, you know, sort of inscribe some limits. So there's like an infinite number of scenarios you can come up with to sort of squeeze them in the cracks of wherever you're committed to. Yeah, like stabbing a liquid is what it says here in the chat. That's exactly right. So yes, I think it is blatantly ad hoc. Oh, sure, yeah. So ad hoc is just saying it's to this is literally what it means. And what it means is, when you have a hypothesis and there's evidence that seems contrary to it, you redefine the hypothesis so that it incorporates the new evidence. So it's the opposite of predictive. Rather than predicting new occurrences, it's retrospective, like with Craig's view, for example. There's literally nothing in Christian theology that predicts Adam and Eve existed 750,000 years ago. He's created this theory so that it incorporates all the different pieces of evidence. And that's how it is with Adam and Eve, I think, that most of these constructions are sort of ad hoc. They're like, well, here's our starting assumption, now let's incorporate all the evidence as best we can.
Is that going to be a symptom of any historical or literary reasoning?
So, okay, I mean, scientists do this all the time. It's not like it's just theologians that do this. Scientists do this all the time. They start, you know, whenever you have a particular pet theory and you have data that contradicts it, you redefine the theory, tweak the edges so that that data is no longer that frightening. Now, interesting book on this, Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. If you keep doing that enough, eventually your theory is going to fall apart and you have to make a new theory. This was exactly what happened in the Copernican Revolution. More and more pieces of motion were not able to be, you know, harmonized with the reigning theory, so they threw it out and then built a new one from the ground up. So I did have one other comment on the people dying before the fall and all that. The one version that I have heard that's mildly persuasive is if you take that sequential view. Genesis 1 is an en masse creation of human beings, and Genesis 2 is a separate thing altogether. This dovetails nicely with Ben's comment earlier. Human beings were told to fill the earth and subdue it. That's sexual reproduction and presumably hunting vicious beasts that are all over the planet and doing very dangerous things. To subdue the planet is not an easy task. Built in with that claim is that people are going to die and they're going to have to reproduce in order to replace the ones that are missing. So if you just take Genesis 1 by itself and completely chop it in half, truncate it away from Genesis 2, and say God created a mass of human beings that then went out and started hunting and killing and, you know, agriculturaling and reproducing everywhere, that might work. And then God says, now we're going to elevate things by bringing Adam and Eve into the picture. That could probably work, again, to use our new word, blatantly ad hoc. Like,
people would be forerunners for the sake of Adam and Eve, so that Adam and Eve kind of had footholds.
Yeah, because
you say they do have the image of God. Well, didn't they in Genesis 1 when he says,
and made them in his image. Yeah, so
but they just didn't fall.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So Adam. So here's the thing. Craig's definition of the image of God is only one tiny sliver of like 1,000 views that are out there. Oh, I can't remember the name of the paper. But basically, the image of God is really just you're called to do God's function, whatever it is. That's the functionalist view as opposed to the structuralist view. As long as you have certain functions, in other words, it's the functions are the precursor to the image, not the other way around. If you have the image of God, then you have those structures, but not if you have those structures, then you have those functions. If God calls people to hunt and kill and subdue the earth, you're going to need certain structures to be able to do that. And so they would be in the image of God, but it doesn't adhere to this image of God as inherited from Adam and Eve view. There are interesting speculations on whether aliens, hypothetical extraterrestrials, would be in the image of God based off of this similar reasoning. So it's
probably also helpful to add a distinction that in some way we can say all creation is in the image of God, and there's a different sense in which we mean it for specifically Adam and Eve, because mm-hmm. all being comes from God, and that which has being is therefore a part of God's image. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, exactly.
What we mean for Adam and Eve and what we mean for all creation.
Yeah, exactly. So the debate over the image of God is dramatically complicated. Because here's the other thing, too. Like, Craig, for example, he's like, oh, yeah, you have to have all these structures. You got to have brain capacity. You got all this to be in the image of God. All you have to do is just say, okay, fine. So fetuses, not in the image of God. They have a zero brain capacity, or like they have a single like milliliter of a brain. So they're not in the image of God, right? Of course, Craig doesn't believe that. So what does he do? Oh, my goodness. It's such nonsensical, like, backwards, gymnastic, ad hoc reasoning to get around this. Just admit the image of God's not structuralist. You don't have to. Anyway, I'm putting too many of my cards on the table. Sorry. The last comment I had on this, which was this idea of an en masse creation and all that. Consider, for example, or just consider this thought. The command of God in Genesis 1 is to subdue the earth, like, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth, and fill it with your progeny. It seems a bit odd to suggest that Adam and Eve do that all by themselves. Just the two of them. Like, think about it. Just two people are going to take over the whole planet. All it takes is one kid, and then Adam gets stomped by a mastodon, and then boom, the project's over, right? So it seems to me that, that's actually one argument kind of, sort of, it's very, small, but it kind of suggests maybe that there's something more going on with this Genesis 1 narrative than what's going on in Genesis 2. But, okay, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Think Theism is made in association with Rasha Christi at Texas A&M University. We invite you to join the weekly Rasha Christi meetings every Thursday. The views and opinions that are expressed in all of our episodes are of the speakers only and are not necessarily endorsed by Rasha Christi nor by Texas A&M University. For more information, go to thinktheism.org.